that I don't have any disclosures. So I'm presenting today on a project, one of several projects that we've been doing with Native Americans in Connecticut. We have a multidisciplinary research team, and these are the members of our team. Dr. Weiner is a medical anthropologist. I'm a nurse. Mr. Samos is a clinical counselor and also a our project manager kind of role. And Dr. Wampler is an epidemiologist. So we've really brought together people from diverse areas in health, as well as we live in different parts of the country. Mark is the only one that actually lives in Connecticut. Diane is in Vermont. I'm in Wisconsin. And Nina is here in Colorado. So it brings different views. It brings some challenges in terms of connecting. But I think we've learned how to work as a team in different areas. And so that has helped us then work with tribes that are dispersed so we can apply some of the things that we've learned from working, how to work better as our within our own team to how to work better than with the tribes that we're trying to connect with in Connecticut. We also have a diverse group of consultants, both native and non-native, and they come from various backgrounds, also medicine and education, and they have been very valuable in helping us be aware of things that maybe we hadn't considered or think about issues that come to light, and then how do we deal with those during the course of the projects. So our projects are based on the principles of community-based participatory research, and toward that goal, we gathered with members of Native American communities in Connecticut, and the three tribes that we work specifically with are the Mashantucket Pequot Nation, the Eastern Pequot Nation, and the Scaticoke Nation. And this is a logo that we developed, and you'll see that the bottom of all the slides includes a part of the logo. Those are kind of visual of wampum beads, which are valuable to Native communities in Connecticut. And then we develop our Cancer Advisory Board, the Northeast Tribal Cancer Advisory Board, which is made up of members from the three tribes, as well as cancer survivors, and we meet regularly, kind of depending on the project. Some of the grants that we've had, we've met like every other month or quarterly. When we don't have any funding, then we try and just get together, you know, conference call, just to keep people engaged and involved. And so the advisory board has really been a staple in terms of really trying to stay connected with the community, as well as they've been valuable in helping us recruit either into research projects or to promote education sessions that we've been developing. In terms of those relationships with the community, it's very important, just as the previous speaker was saying, you know, how do you develop those relationships and then maintain them for the long term? We really have a commitment to these communities. We first started working with them in 2005. We had some pilot money to have a planning meeting, and I really think that is so important so that you can really sit down and have a conversation about what are those issues that are most important for you as tribal members. You know, we are talking about cancer, that's our expertise, but there's a lot of things we could look at in terms of cancer. So what is really important for all of you? And that's really been then the framework that we have used over the past 5 years, is trying to, you know, talk about as we move forward, or we have a different grant, or we're applying for a different kind of maybe some different money. How do we stay connected and then take your agenda forward instead of focusing on what our agenda is? This is a photo of Agnes Cunha. She is an Eastern Pequot tribal elder, and she has been the major motivator for our project. She is a two-time cancer survivor, and she is so trustworthy. I'm glad you asked that question of trust and talked about that, because that is really essential. There's a lot of mistrust in Native communities historically and currently, and having her be, she's on our advisory board, she's one of our cancer facilitators, she is so committed to this work that she keeps us all going, frankly, and when we all get together, there's Agnes to say, okay, what are we going to do next? You know, what's the next project? Where are we going to meet? And so having that, those relationships develop over time is really incredibly valuable. The particular project I'm going to focus mostly on this morning was a NCI-funded project to look specifically at the CIS, which we really don't have much of anymore, but we had a very active CIS in New England at the time. And so we were interested in looking at both community members as well as health professionals' perspectives of knowledge of and use of the CIS. And what I think is really has been a strength of our team is that we have people who do both qualitative and quantitative research approaches. So we use a mixed methods, which then we are able to gather data from a variety of sources and have people to analyze that data. And we've been able to then develop our programs really based on these initial studies. So that's been a real strength of the team approach. So we surveyed Native American community members in Connecticut, a fairly low response rate, unfortunately. And I think part of this is the method that we use. It was a paper survey. Some people do not have internet access, so we didn't go with any kind of an internet approach. And also we worked with our advisory board, and the advisory board members who are liaisons to the tribes, they maintained control of those tribal member lists. They were very uncomfortable, and I think this is trust issues, with actually giving us those lists so that we could mail surveys directly. So they maintained control of the list. They, you know, we put the surveys together and really worked with the board to make sure that the surveys were understandable. We had multiple iterations. We had meetings with cancer survivors and other community members just to look at the surveys, make sure that they were understandable for community members. But then we had to kind of turn it all over to our advisory board members to do the actual mailing. And I think that contributed to our low response rate because we weren't able to follow up. We couldn't send follow-up postcards because they really maintained control of that. On the other hand, with our healthcare professional survey, we did have a better response rate, not great, but better. And I think this was because we controlled those surveys and we did a lot of outreach. Whenever there was a meeting in Connecticut that we thought there would be health professionals there, one of us was at that meeting, and we would distribute, like this kind of meeting, we would have been distributing surveys and trying to get them back. So we had a little better response rate on that. I'm not going to talk about the healthcare professional responses today. I'm really going to focus specifically on the community member results. So this slide just gives you kind of an overview of the demographic profile of who completed those surveys. Although it was only 19% response rate, I think that it was somewhat representative of the tribes that we work with. There tends to be more women involved and engaged in the work that we're doing, so I'm kind of not surprised that more women completed the survey. About a little over half were employed full-time. I think in Connecticut, I don't know, anyone from the East? No, a couple of you. I mean, I think there's this misnomer that all the tribes in Connecticut are rich because of casino gambling. And that really is not the case. The three tribes we work with, only one tribe is federally recognized, the Mashantucket, and they do have gaming. The Eastern Pequot are not federally recognized, but they are state recognized, but that does not really mean a lot in terms of benefits or anything. And the Scaticoke Nation are not recognized at all, so they're no different from anyone else in terms of the benefits that they receive. So there's a lot of income disparities that exist within the tribes. Some of these tribes are very poor, and so that employment is reflected of that. There are a lot of also higher cancer rates among some of the tribes. Connecticut has some of the highest breast cancer rates in the country. And so I think we're working against some of those myths in Connecticut that, well, you know, you don't need services or resources because, you know, all those tribes are rich, and really that isn't the case. You know, 63% education passed high school. That's fairly high for this sample. I think among those tribes, it is not quite that high. And then it's just the breakout of the three tribes. So in terms of the CIS, 81% did not know about the CIS, and we really weren't surprised about that. We did work with members of the CIS on this project, and you know, they were really interested at that time trying to identify ways to increase people's knowledge of the CIS, both in terms of community members as well as healthcare providers. However, 60% of people did look for cancer information because their tribes are greatly affected by cancer, and so there is that need for information. And then these are the various sources of information that people relied upon. We also did qualitative data collection. We interviewed individuals through groups. That was any Native community members that were interested in attending group just to talk about cancer information, where they got their information, what were considered reliable sources. And then we also did individual interviews with cancer survivors or their loved ones. And so that was a way then we could find out very specifically from people who have cancer, what were some of those resources that they found useful and reliable. So as you can see with that family history, very high again among the individuals that we interviewed, as well as those that were in the group interviews, and consistently high family history of cancer. So this is just some of the differences in terms of the results, differences in ways people talked about cancer. Many didn't had limited access to or knowledge about reliable resources. And in some situations, it was very risky to talk about cancer. That might have been seen as a weakness to seek out information. Very different from diabetes. You go in and talk to a group about diabetes, and everyone will talk to you about diabetes. Many people have diabetes or family members. You talk about cancer, and there's kind of this quiet. And we kind of were thinking that may be partly that cancer hasn't been on kind of the forefront in terms of Indian Health Service or tribal health care clinics. Also within some tribes, you just don't talk about it. It's just not something that people are comfortable talking about. I mean, it's also more hidden. People, and I remember specifically in the focus group, some people saying, well, you know, I didn't even know my mom had cancer till she was dying, because people were hiding that from one another. And so that makes it really difficult then if people need information, but nobody wants to talk about it. We found that the main source of information really was trusted people, that trust issue again, and cancer survivors. When we would do our focus groups, we say, well, we're planning to do, because we had also had a Lance Armstrong grant at the time, and part of that grant was to develop cancer information education sessions. So we would say, well, we're going to have these sessions, and you know, what would make them successful? And almost 100% of the time, people would say, well, you have to have natives with cancer. They need to be a part of it. They are who we go to. They're reliable. We trust them. And if you didn't know someone with cancer, a family member would be the next person. Health professionals were pretty far down on the list. They were not the folks that people went to initially. What happened sometimes is that people would go to the internet, get all this information, but then they wouldn't know what to do with it. They either didn't understand it, or that it was too high a reading level, or too much jargon. And so then they would take it back to some other family members, or maybe a cancer survivor, and say, can you help me sort through this information? Because we need it, but it doesn't make sense. And then some of the approaches that people use to access cancer information, like I said, really looking at storytelling. Intergenerational storytelling has we've identified as really important. So if someone in a family has cancer and they're willing to talk about it with the next group of people, that is a way then to continue that transmission of information. And people learn through stories. We, in our education sessions that we do now, we have a talking circle format, and a part of that is telling stories, sharing what that cancer experience was like, and then opening up for questions, and then having our Native cancer survivors as facilitators there to really help people talk about these issues, process what's going on, find resources, and we've also been developing some more culturally specific resources for people. So in terms of some of the strategies we've identified to increase access to cancer resources, culturally specific curriculum, we have developed modules that we use that look at particular topics that people identified. And we were kind of surprised. People wanted to know a lot about cancer in the environment. That was really important. And so we've integrated that. We do these wellness, cancer, and prevention circles. So again, a safe place where people can come and talk about cancer with Native cancer survivors there to provide support and information. We've created the first Native American cancer survivor archive. It's housed at the Mashantucket Pequot Library and Museum. And this project, too, really supports that notion of intergenerational knowledge. So cancer survivors sharing their stories and then having it be part of this permanent archive that will be there for seven generations, which Native people often talk about, seven generations into the future, so that it's there and people can go and read the transcripts and then learn more about that cancer experience. And then we developed a state specific cancer resource guide for Connecticut so that it would have updated information around screening, early detection, as well as Native specific resources primarily through the internet. So people would know what is Native specific for them. This is another photo from one of our sessions that we did about a year ago. We always have food. It's a Native tradition, and it brings people together. And generally, we eat first, and then we talk, and then maybe eat again. And it, I think it improves the whole mood of the session, as well as helping people feel more comfortable sharing about cancer. I don't really have time, but this is just goes through some of the specifics with developing the archive. I'll just warn you, if this is something you think you might want to do with communities, really research it, because this is one where we had one line in our Lance Armstrong grant that we thought, oh, it'd be great to work with the museum and create this archive. No budget for it, no time devoted to it, but it took huge amounts of time, and it was really much more labor intensive than we ever imagined. But it's something permanent now that really people can look to. We have a link on the library and museum website, so people can go to that. We had an opening reception, people came, and so it really brought the community together. Again, another way to share information about cancer that was more trusting and less intrusive. So in terms of some of the next things we're planning to do, we're always looking to move into new tribal communities. So we've been working in Rhode Island. We've done some cancer sessions with the Narragansett tribe, and we're hoping to move into Massachusetts and Maine with some other projects that we're developing. Just recently, we've added creative arts to our session, and this has been very popular. So generally, we would have like a kind of a standard like this, you know, give a little brief presentation. We would have a talking circle where people could share their stories. And then we would, now people said, well, that's not enough. We really want art. We want to be able to do something while this is going on. And so we've had a couple sessions with creating posters about what it means to have cancer, or what does that word cancer, when you hear that, what does that mean for you? And so people have created these posters that then we're photographing, and we're going to use as a way to advertise programs and resources throughout the state. So that's been really exciting. And then involving more Native American researchers. I am not Native. Our epidemiologist is Native, and some of our consultants are Native, but this is really key, again, to that trust and understanding of the communities, but it's very difficult. There are not many, especially doctorally prepared Native researchers, especially in the East, but that's really an important goal, and then, as all of you, looking for more money so that we can continue to do the projects that we have started. And we have some projects we just do and we don't have any money, and looking at ways that we can get just a little support for, like in-kind donations and things, to keep the momentum going. Because that's our fear, is that if we stop, and then people will Again, NAP trusts that, well, you just came in and did what you did, and now you're done with us. So we really want to try and keep that momentum. Thank you. Any questions? Oh, sorry. Yes.
I'm curious to know, how did you address the questions people had about the environment and cancer? Because that can get
It can. And so we would generally talk more in general about, you know, these are some ideas that people have about the environment, or, you know, looking at, there's a large nuclear sub plant, I don't know what you call it, a plant or operation in Groton, Connecticut. And so I think people can connect the radiation with the increased cancer rates, and there is some evidence to suggest that the more radiation you're exposed to, the increase in your cancer risk. And so we can bring in some examples like that, but that's a challenge. And so we, you know, when we heard that, then it was, well, we better go into the literature, see what we can find, but then make it presented in a way that it's understandable. And I think part of it is that people also, they just wanted to talk about it. They wanted to have a space so they could kind of just talk about these theories that they have or what they heard. And so sometimes our job is really more either affirming, yes, that's accurate, that kind of based on the current science, that's accurate, or no, that's really a myth. You know, there really isn't anything. We don't know that it's not true, but to this date, there isn't any, you know, scientific evidence to support that. So sometimes that's how some of these sessions kind of evolve, is that we have our agenda and what we think we'd like to cover, but then they have lots of questions that kind of go off in different tangents. Yes?
Who led your focus groups?
I led some of the focus groups, and then our medical anthropologists led some of the focus groups. And we tried hosting them at different times of day, different places. Some were the most successful in terms of the numbers that came. We actually had during the lunch hour at one of the work sites, so people could just come on their lunch. We didn't have as much time then. We maybe only had 45 minutes or an hour at the most, but we had, it was convenient. People could just come from the building and have, like we did one at tribal headquarters, so people that were at work could just come and do that. We also would go to people. We did some with students, Native American students at some of the university. We partner with UConn and Yale and Connecticut College, so we try and go to them to make that. We also did one session. I think we traveled to the western part of the state and did a session like over dinner. So a variety of ways that we try to make it more convenient for people. And we always had, I shouldn't say always, but generally tried to have a cancer survivor at one of those sessions if possible who was Native. Yes?
I noticed when you talked about the people that they go to when they want information,
mm-hmm.
you listed survivors higher up on the list. I'm just wondering, how does an ordinary person identify a cancer survivor in their community?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I was going to talk a little bit more. Right. I think this, you know, there are many different communities within Native. There's family, kind of, so that intergenerational family lines. There's also the tribe itself, so people see that tribe as their family. So if they have really close connections with the tribe, they would see that, and so people might talk a little bit more. And then actually some of the kind of the boundaries that the federal government sets, well, you're this tribe or this tribe, those are really, incorrect, because tribal boundaries are much more fluid. And so we have some tribal members, well, their parent was Narragansett, and their mom was Narragansett, and their dad was Mashantucket. Well, so they're really a member of both of those tribes. And so I think there was just a lot more of this kind of insider knowing of who had cancer. And so, because they did share it with family, but it, when you have family in both tribes, for example, or you have families who are alive, you know, you have four generations of families, so you're willing to talk about it within the families. We did see some of the tribes that were more willing to be open and talk about cancer or any health issues. So there was that variability. But I think that was part of kind of our thinking with our program is that we had cancer survivors who, you know, once they had cancer, they were willing to go out there. They wanted to talk about what their experience was like, and they didn't really have a place to do that. So our project has kind of provided a forum now. And so people, Agnes, they know Agnes. And so if there's a question about cancer, they might say, oh, well, I could call Agnes. I know she would talk to me about that. Or, you know, we would, or then we have some other facilitators who, once they had, it's kind of like once they had the support of the program and the support of one another, they then had more courage to move forward and talk about their experiences, and then other people would see that and then go to them. So I think it's been a process over time, but it certainly is an issue for many people, and our programs aren't, you know, we can't reach even half the people that we want to, but word of mouth is a really good way to spread the word. Great. Well, thank you very much.